directly to a public hearing on Senate Bill 18, and I would ask Senator Gordley to come and give us her testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Avell Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Portland. I am here in support of Senate Bill 18. I would also like to have included in the record that I am a founder of the African American Mental Health Commission, a member of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and co-chair of the Legislative Mental Health Caucus, along with Senator Brown. I am the parent of a son who is diagnosed schizophrenic. He suffered neglect and mistreatment while in the care and custody of the state hospital. By neglect, I mean treatment was withheld for a significant period of time, exacerbating his mentally ill condition, and his diagnosis was wrongfully changed by a culturally incompetent medical staff member. One of the so-called professional medical staff even said that he thought my son was feigning his illness, even though he had been previously hospitalized at the Oregon State Hospital and several other hospitals in Portland over a 10-year period of time. The investigation of my son's abuse included allegations of racism, which the investigation found that because he didn't hear the racial slurs uttered by hospital staff, he was not harmed. The investigation of my son's abuse was conducted through the governor's office and involved the Department of Justice and outside culturally competent mental health professionals. We basically had to create a process that would hopefully be fair and unbiased. On reflection, the result of the investigation was only satisfactory. I have no idea what reforms have been implemented at the state hospital since the abuse. Nothing has been reported to me or to my son about reform. After the investigation, I said publicly that I had faith that reform and training would be implemented. But again, after all this time, I cannot tell you what has changed at the state hospital. My son certainly has grounds for a lawsuit against the state, but he is not interested in pursuing that route and going through all of that. We do want reform and accountability, and this legislature has the power through policy and purse strings to make that happen so that no one else ever has to experience what he did. What we do want to see, what I would like to see, are the kinds of reforms laid out in the language of this legislation, Senate Bill 18. I urge you to pass the bill and demand accountability from the Oregon State Hospital as well about what they are doing to train a staff to become culturally competent. And I urge you to also add language on line 14 of the bill after the word experiences that says, and in parentheses, I would say, including multicultural experience. Again, on line 14.
Could you repeat that so we get the proper exact wording here that you had? You'd want a comma then after experience, or just a insert?
After experiences, after experience, comma, including multicultural experience. And that, Mr. Chair, is the extent of my testimony, and I'm very grateful to the Oregon Advocacy Center. I know they had a role in bringing this subject and this issue forward, and we're very grateful for the work they do in the community on behalf of the mentally ill and the developmentally disabled.
I want to go over this one other time. I have trouble how to make this wording here. You say experience, comma, including multicultural?
Multicultural competence, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Experience.
Well, competence is different than necessarily experience.
Mm-hmm. Competence.
Yeah.
Competence. Competence.
Okay. Yeah, I guess have a question, and I'm going to kick out here right now. If we're going to put in there something that puts people responsible for withholding, and just as a blanket statement, and we don't have the money to fund that, how do we deal with that?
Well, let me respond in this way, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Again, looking at Section 3 and reading the entire section, it says that any designee of the Department of Human Services who makes a determination or conducts an investigation under ORS 430.743 or 430.745 shall have adequate training and experience. And I am recommending the addition of the phrase including multicultural experience to make the determination or conduct a thorough and unbiased investigation. With that said, the fact is that there are going to be those occasions when investigations must be conducted. And what this language says, and what I'm asking you to include, is a statement that says the people who do the investigating must have certain training and experience, but they must also be culturally competent. Again, these are investigations that are going to happen from time to time. We just want to make sure that the people who are conducting them have the skills and expertise, the ability to look holistically at situations that may arise.
Yeah. I guess I didn't ask my question thoroughly enough. It's a little later on here where it says neglect leads to physical harm through withholding on line 28 there on the first page, withholding of services necessary. If we don't have the money to fund those things and those services are withheld, how do we get around, and we pass a bill like this, how do we get around dealing with this? Because I've got a feeling that because of the lawsuit that was mentioned that apparently was just filed today or just very recently concerning the Indigent Defense Funds, there comes a limit. The courts can demand that we do thus and thus and thus, and when the people have taken it in their hands and said you only have this much money and it won't cover thus and thus and thus, how do we work to answer the problem that is created by simply not enough money to go around?
Mr. Chair, I would say that the issue for me isn't money. It is what shall be the policy of the state with regard to how persons who are mentally ill or who are developmentally disabled or who are in some other way incapacitated in the state's care, what shall be our policy with regard to how we treat them and how we allow them to be treated. And I think that's what the Senate Bill 18 before you is attempting to address. In Section 4, there is a listing of statements that define what abuse means. And what's being added to the list is item E, which says that neglect that leads to physical harm through withholding of services necessary to maintain health and well-being. In my son's case, it would have been the withholding of treatment, withholding of medication for a period of time. That was the form of neglect in his case. again, the reality is that there are lawsuits out there. There will be other lawsuits given the crisis that the state faces. But that does not exempt the legislature and all of us from putting into statute language that protects our most vulnerable citizens from abuse.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
And I understand what the chairman's getting at as well as what you're getting at here. Maybe it would be helpful on line 28 to add a word and just say neglect that leads to physical harm through withholding of available services necessary. Would that be a helpful change to get around? And for example, we are not, under anybody's estimation, providing all the services that are necessary because of budget concerns to a large number of people. But I think in the case you talk about, services were available in that setting and were nevertheless being denied to one person, that being your son. So I'm thinking, you know, I just wanted to get your read on that, whether that would be a constructive change as far as you're concerned.
I would, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I would frankly have some difficulty with the use of the word in that way, because again, reading the entire statement, E, neglect that leads to physical harm through withholding of services necessary to maintain health and well-being. That's the spirit of the language and the law. It's not about available services. It's about what are the services that are necessary to maintain the health and well-being of an individual. And then, again, in the case that I'm speaking about, or the experience I'm speaking about, was, you know, a person in a mental health, a person in a state hospital who should have received treatment, should have received medication, and the issue wasn't whether it was available or not. The issue was that it was required for his health and to maintain his health and well-being, and it was withheld.
No, but I guess what I was trying to get at is that those services and those drugs, those medications, were available to people that they determined needed them, and for whatever reason, they determined that your son, wrongfully determined that your son did not need them. So, but on the other hand, it wasn't some new program that might have benefited, maybe that's being used somewhere else in the country that just wasn't available there. That's what I'm trying to get at, not just, you know, whether it's available for him, but whether it's generally available in that setting and not being provided to get around the budget constraints, because we're not, you know, there, you know, if you talk about health and well-being, I mean, that's a big area.
Well, again, and I don't know any other way, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, to respond other than in the way that I already have, which is to say that budget constraints should not guide public policy that protects the well-being of our most vulnerable citizens. It's not about whether we have the money or not. It should not be about whether we have the money or not to pay for the services. It should be about what are the policies and practices that we want to ensure are in place to protect the most vulnerable people. Now, whether we are willing as a legislature and as a state full of citizen taxpayers to pay for the services is another question, and in fact, it's a moral question as well. But that's how I would respond.
I agree with you there. Thank you.
I hope, Mr. Chair, that you'll also and Senator Burdick also raise the same question with the folks from the Oregon Advocacy Center, because I'm sure they have some other experiences that would help to flesh out how and why the language is the way it is or whether it should be amended.
That's where I go.
I just have, I guess, a problem, and fortunately I'll probably be relieved of that problem to a certain extent, because this is to be referred to judiciary, but the very word neglect, because I could see that professional judgment might be used to not do something or other, and that in turn might be labeled neglect, and I don't know just what all the proper definitions of neglect and those kind of things are, so we may get a little help from that from the Judiciary Committee. But anyway, it's good to get a discussion going on here and to find out as much as we can so we don't have you down here 15 times trying to testify to the same thing.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify again about a policy that we really do need to put in place, and the experience that I'm speaking from has been certainly a very painful one, and it's a very emotional one as well to sit here and talk to you about. But again, this is about protecting the people in our society who are the most vulnerable.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Greg Monaco from Multnomah. And Stuart Branham from ODC. And Bob Jundiff. I think we got three chairs up here. Would it be possible? Oh, you made it. Okay. I was going to see if we could get a quick shift here so you didn't have to go all the way around, but that's fine. Go ahead, Greg, whenever you're ready.
I gave a document to your staff here, which will be circulated. My name is Greg Monaco. I'm a mental health professional in Multnomah County. I don't represent Multnomah County, and they don't represent me. So I'm coming here as a private citizen.
Okay.
Speak in support of this bill.
Well, I noticed you just had Multnomah down there. You didn't have county, so I didn't say county.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah. Multnomah County, excuse me. Since 1987, as a civil commitment investigator in Portland, I've evaluated hundreds of suicidal and other mentally disabled patients on psychiatric wards, and I decide on a daily basis whether they're safe to return to the community or whether a commitment hearing might be necessary. I'm part of a team which conducted 3,800 such investigations in Multnomah County in 2002 alone. In March of 1999, Elise John, a suicidal and psychotic patient who'd agreed to be committed only 2 weeks before, was given an unaccompanied nighttime pass by the hospital and hanged herself that night from the Morrison Bridge in Portland. She was a 28-year-old poet and graduate of Marquette University, whose family, incidentally, had founded a charity in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which funds, among other things, housing for the mentally disabled. As I discovered, the subsequent investigation of her death, known as a protective service investigation, which was conducted by the county's mental health division, was error-ridden and perfunctory and seemed adverse to finding any fault with the county's contractor, the hospital. Furthermore, the investigation did not address in any way whether county practices or lack of vigilance may have contributed to Ms. John's death, nor was the patient's family even interviewed regarding any of their unanswered questions. The outcome was that no corrective measures were implemented and that the family did not receive so much as an apology. They deserved better. Later, the Oregon Advocacy Center reexamined Ms. John's suicide and concluded that the county's report was compromised by the inherent conflict of interest of a program investigating itself and its contractor, and also lacked both thoroughness and independence. For the almost 4 years since Ms. John's death, I've advocated for improved oversight of the protective services function. The Multnomah County Mental Health Task Force, which was appointed by former County Chair Beverly Stein and staffed by former legislator Mike McCracken, recommended that an ombudsman oversight function become part of the planned mental health redesign, and later the Board of County Commissioners adopted a resolution regarding the same. However, this has never been implemented. Consequently, I've been advocating as best I can, including a couple of essays published in the Oregonian. The most recent, which you have there, called Set Up for Suicide, was published on January 2nd and coincided with the special report Out of the Shadows written by Michelle Roberts, which described numerous suicides which seemed preventable and which received little or no review, which could be described as either independent or thorough. As I state in one of my essays, one former administrator cited as an argument against an independent review of the notorious death of a patient at Pacific Gateway Hospital, quote, "It's very difficult to find a true independent entity in any community, but certainly one like Portland." More recently, a current administrator is quoted as saying, "There are huge problems with the system, but nothing we're not aware of." Obviously, these aren't arguments for maintaining the status quo. My own observations support the Oregonians that sufficient monitoring of critical incidents, particularly suicides, is lacking. Most bureaucracies do a poor job of policing themselves, even in the best of times. But particularly in the current fiscal environment, there may be a resignation that suicides are unavoidable because of cuts to certain services. Harboring this bias of inevitability, some may be tempted to throw up their hands. What also tends to happen is blaming the victim or an individual professional rather than the administrative lapses that set them up for tragedy. As we know, blame tends to flow downhill. Unless we want to be left with a cynical view that suicides are inevitable or that lawsuits are what it will take to change things, improved and coordinated investigations of suicides and other alleged patient abuses are needed now more than ever as services are in short supply. Besides promoting accountability, improvement in this vital area would have the benefit of both correction and prevention. This is the right thing to do for the families of suicide victims and for future suicidal citizens whose deaths might be prevented if we act now. Particularly in a lien system, we need to safeguard our most vulnerable, setting standards in place which guarantee we're doing the very best with the safety net services we have left. I want to conclude by giving you an example of something that happened just last week. I was investigating a very depressed patient who was having terrible intrusive thoughts. He entered a hospital to seek treatment, hoping his impulses would subside. Neither the hospitals nor the psychiatrist nor I believed he should be discharged. The thoughts he was having, which he was trying to control, were to kill himself and to, quote, "take others with me." Nevertheless, I received a call from another county employee, the person in charge of the patient's insurance authorization through the Oregon Health Plan. She said that she and his outpatient providers, who happened to be at financial risk for his hospitalization, wanted me, and this is a quote, to call his bluff regarding his suicidal and homicidal plans and discharge him. I refused to do that, but what if I'd caved into the pressure and tragedy had resulted? Hopefully, call their bluff is not the new slogan of how a money-strapped mental health division plans to address the threats of suicidal patients. However, by passing this bill before you for thorough and independent investigations of patient deaths, abuses, and neglect, you're putting administrators who might otherwise be tempted to be preoccupied with the bottom line on notice that on behalf of vulnerable citizens and their families, you plan on watchdogging their every move. Thank you.
Thank
Go ahead, Mr. Brannon.
Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stuart Branham, and I reside in Corvallis, Oregon. I've served two terms on the city council there, and now I'm a Oregon Disability Committee. I'm sorry, Oregon Disability Committee representative. I'm here today because of the Oregon Disability Commission, and I'd like to report that the commission has reviewed Senate Bills 18, 37, 118, and 119, and we're substantially in support of these bills. We realize that there are going to be some slight changes to at least two of these bills, 18 and Bill 118, and there may be more to other bills, but substantially we're in support of the four bills, and we would like to go on record stating that fact.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bob, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. Back before 1991, in the interim before the 1991 legislative session, I was on a work group that developed the legislation that created the abuse reporting and investigation system for folks with mental illness and developmental disabilities. The reason that we worked on that at that time was because there was something that particularly the folks on the developmental disabilities side were working on called protective services as part of the job that they did every day, and that is because they serve vulnerable people, and that from time to time there'd be reports that a person was in trouble, being hurt, somehow being put at risk. And the what was then called the Mental Health Division would want to investigate those situations or have the county investigate those situations. But in order to investigate a situation, you have to have authority to do that, or else a provider can keep the door shut, a person can refuse to talk, and it can become impossible to find out what's going on so that you can step in and find out what happened and try to avoid further harm, if in fact harm has occurred. And that's what this statute that will be put in place did, both for developmentally disabled and folks with mental illness, is it put in place legislative authority for that authorizes people to report when they see a situation in which they suspect abuse. And it gives authority for the state or their designee to investigate that abuse, to find out what's going on, and then to take action to try to protect the person from further harm if that's an issue. So if you look into the whole group of statutes, what it does is that the person reports in good faith, they really think it happened, something happened, that they cannot be blamed or held liable for doing that, and that the state or their designee then has authority to step in and take a look and see what's going on. Now, what type of teeth does the state or their designee have at that point? Let's say that there is abuse, or they found abuse, or they think there is abuse. What can they do? Well, what the law says is that they can write a report. They can send that information to licensing agencies so that if the abuse occurred in a facility of some sort, they can send the report to that licensing agency. Or if the person involved with the abuse is a licensed professional, they can send that report to that licensing agency. That's it. That's exactly what is encompassed in the entire statute. It's something to encourage people to report and to give the state or their designee the authority to investigate that report, and then to write a and then to come to some conclusions and tell perhaps other state agencies about it. This particular statute at that time was modeled on existing law covering senior citizens. And much of the language was, I wish I could report we were more creative, but in fact, we basically took the language of that statute and replicated it for the most part. One thing we didn't bring over from that statute was neglect. And that wording was in the senior abuse statute at that time, the exact language that's in our bill today. And at that time, the thinking was that we wanted to take one step at a time, not in developmental disabilities where the work on abuse investigation had been going on for some time and there were rules to support it, but particularly mental health, where this was something new, even though it was recognized that Medicaid law seemed to mandate that some type of abuse investigation take place. It really hadn't been incorporated into Oregon law. So it was a first step. That was 12 years ago. In the meantime, we've had an opportunity to see how that law works, how it doesn't work, and there, like most things, there are parts of it that don't work and parts of it that do. But one of the things that we've come to recognize, or we believe, and we believe that the Department of Human Services would echo this, is that there has been a lack of clarity in terms of what constitutes quote-unquote abuse. And in fact, while some will look at any situation where a person is endangered, truly endangered, and report about that situation, some are more hesitant to do so because they're concerned that some situations might not come right within the letter of the definition. And that's why we wanted to bring neglect in. Just as with the senior abuse situation, which is we've had for, I didn't check it, but we've had at least 15 or 20 years, we wanted to make sure that the situation where developmentally disabled folks with mental illness, were covered by this statute, that if a reporter sees a situation in which a person is not getting vital services, that they can let somebody know about it and that it can be investigated. Parenthetically, an unusual but a troubling situation that was covered in the Oregonian articles that Mr. Monaco related earlier was a situation in which a woman in a foster care environment in the Coos Bay area was allowed to starve to death in that facility. That's the kind of neglect we're talking about here. We're talking about severe deprivations that lead to physical harm. One could argue whether that's abuse or not. I think all well-meaning people would want to investigate that situation if they knew about it, certainly. But whether in fact it would be mandated under our present law, it's certainly worth debating. So that's why we think it's important to have abuse in the statute. And according to what we're told by the Department of Human Services, really if they receive those complaints or the counties do, it's expected that that's the kind of dangerous situation that they want to look at. But there might be some doubt as to whether they have the authority to do so. And by adding abuse into the definition, we feel that we could eliminate any doubt about that. I noticed that there was a concern raised by the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs that somehow adding neglect could create some type of liability for the state or the counties. Now, I can understand that concern. These are horrible times. We're cutting vital services. We all know it. So the question really is, would somehow adding this phrase create some sort of liability for someone? In my opinion, it wouldn't, and the reason is that this is a set of statutes that only mandates a reporting and investigation. It doesn't set the standard of care. It doesn't purport to set a standard of care. Now, all it it's all it does, and as I said in the senior abuse area, it's done so for years and years, is say, these are the situations that we would like to see reported. These are the situations that we're going to investigate. No more, no less, in my opinion. And that's the purpose of this law, and to read more into it, but somehow by saying that, that certain types of circumstances in which a person, we want them to report about a problem, investigate it, somehow sets a standard of care for the state, would be a creative argument. But I don't think it's one that would fly. There are two other portions of Senate Bill 18 that I'd like to comment upon. One has to do with the training experience piece, and Senator Gordley talked a little bit about that. I have talked to the Department of Human Services about the language there. They had some suggestions for altering that language to be a little clearer and to avoid potential fiscal problems. And I saw no problem with that. And if we moved to work session, we would have language that would address their concerns without any difficulty, at least from our part. The second has to do with Section 3, Subsection 2, which has to do with the basically with conflict of interest. Part of Human Services and we have a little bit of a different interpretation of what that language means. They are concerned that it may require more state investigations and that that would have a fiscal impact. They've also informed me that they've developed protocols for dealing with conflicts of interest that they feel adequately addresses the problem that we're concerned about. And in our estimation, that being the case, and certainly understanding that in these difficult fiscal times, that anything that's going to have a add a fiscal burden to the state right now is inappropriate, frankly. We've told them that we'd be willing to have subsection 2 excised from the bill so that the other parts that we feel are very important can go forward. That's my testimony.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone that didn't get a chance to sign up that's come in or wishes to give testimony on Senate Bill 18? I have here a letter that I wish to enter into the record from Gina Furman from the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And it is concerned with the potential of the abuse by neglective services if it extended to those things that were not available due to budget cuts. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 18 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 37. I'll ask staff to give us a rundown on the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 37 modifies the Elderly and Disabled Person Abuse Prevention Act to allow a guardian to file a petition on behalf of an elderly or disabled person.
And we have we have Jennifer Wright from the Oregon State Bar and Claudia Burton from the Elder Law Section. And again, Stuart Branham.
You're okay. He's okay.
He doesn't want to come back up. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Wright. I'm a professor of law at the Willamette University College of Law here in Salem. I direct their clinical law program, and I'm also current chair of the Elder Law Section of the Oregon State Bar Association, a group of attorneys who represent and counsel elderly people and their families. We have about 450 members at this time. And I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 37. This is an amendment to the Elderly and Disabled Persons Abuse Prevention Act, which provides a restraining order to protect the elderly and disabled persons who are victims of specified kinds of abuse. It was originally modeled after the Family Abuse Prevention Act and provides uses a very similar sort of procedure to protect elderly and disabled persons when they're subject to the specified kinds of abuse, and provides protection in terms of restraining order, ordering the abuser to stay away. It provides a move-out order if the abuser is living in the elderly or disabled person's home and the abuse is going on, and provides for certain other relief. Our amendments are actually not very sweeping. The first is probably the most significant one, which allows a guardian or guardian ad litem to seek protection for an elderly or disabled person if they are unable to seek protection for themselves. And we find that in many cases, when abuse is going on, sometimes as a result of the abuse or as a result of disability or age, the person who is the victim of the abuse is not able to come into court, fill out a petition and sign it, and make their own case and request this assistance for themselves, but they desperately need it. What we're proposing is simply to allow someone who has been duly appointed to act on that person's behalf to be able to do it for them. And we do also provide that in that case, when a third party, a guardian or guardian ad litem, is seeking the protection, that notice is given to the elderly or disabled person so that if they don't want this protection and they don't feel it's needed, they are able to appear and oppose it. And then the final change we made is one to, I think, more to clarify the meaning of the bill than of the statute than to change it. As I said, the original Elderly and Disabled Person Abuse Prevention Act was modeled on the Family Abuse Prevention Act. And under that act, in order for a victim of abuse to be entitled to seek relief at all, they must have a certain relationship with the abuser. There must be a domestic relationship between them. They must have either been married or co-parents of a child or have cohabited. And if they don't have one of those relationships, they're not entitled to get a restraining order under the Act. Now, the elderly and disabled Persons Abuse Prevention Act, there is also on the statutory form that is filled out to applying for an order a series of boxes that a person can check which indicate their relationship with the abuser. However, nowhere in the statute, and it was not the intent to imply that unless they had one of these specified relationships, they could not get protection under the Act. However, because of the close association with the Family Abuse Prevention Act, there are some judges and attorneys who have been confused about this, and they understand that if one of these boxes is not checked, perhaps this person is not entitled to relief. And our solution for that was simply, in order to clarify that that was not the case, to add a none of the above box that can be checked and the form can be filled out properly. And we just want to make it clear that anybody who abuses a disabled or elderly person may be restrained under the Act, and it doesn't have to be someone that has a particular familial or living relationship with the elderly disabled person. Thank you.
My name is Claudia Burton, and I work as a pro tem circuit court judge for the Marion County Circuit Court, although I'm not here wearing an official judicial department hat. I'm also a member of the executive committee of the elder law section of the bar, and frankly, Professor Wright has laid it all out very well, and I think I would just say that if you have any questions, I'd be happy to help you out, and other than that, not take up any more of your time.
I guess I'm surprised that this hasn't been available before, because I would have thought that would have been automatic.
I have seen situations where people have to file a guardianship or some other more involved proceeding, because unless the elderly or disabled person goes down and files it themselves, there isn't any way to get that relief. So it's our hope that this would resolve that kind of situation, because as you say, it does seem rather intuitive that some of these folks are just not going to be able to march down to the courthouse and fill out the form.
Well, that was interesting. Although in previous testimony, it sounded like that if one of their guardians did this and they marched down to the court and said they didn't want it, that they could get out, they could stop it.
Well,
so how do you get down to stop it if you can't get down to start it?
Those people may not be able to get down to stop it. What sometimes happens is you get family dynamics where, you know, one son says, my brother is abusing mom and I want to do something about it. And so they run down and file for a restraining order, as they're now allowed to do. Mom doesn't feel like the other son is abusing her, certainly wouldn't have gone down on her own, even though she might have had that capability. And therefore, she has, in other words, that she has the right to not have something done in her name if she objects to that. Any other questions that we can answer for you?
Don't see any evidence right here at the moment.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for taking the time to come and testify on the bill.
Mr. Chair, this is still a subsequent referral to judiciary.
I would guess that all of these do.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I believe that Senate Bill 118 does not have a subsequent referral, but I was planning to look into that.
Okay.
It's pretty straightforward.
I would guess that these will probably be looked at a little more from the legal angle and judiciary.
You can be assured, Mr. Chairman.
What was the public hearing on Senate Bill 37 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 118? And then we have Ed Johnston, is it?
He's not.
Okay, and we have Jennifer Wright again, and Claudia Burton.
Or do you want
to? All right, you prefer, all right. Go ahead, Mr. Shepherd.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd, and evidently I've been nominated to go first. I should provide your staff.
Nominated or railroaded?
Mr. Chair, I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and one of the tasks that I have is to serve as the Attorney General's designee on what's known as the Attorney General's Task Force on Elder Abuse. That's a task force that then Attorney General Kulongoski convened in 1994, and Attorney General Myers has continued it in force since then. Senate Bill 118 is one of the measures that that task force has asked to be advanced and that it supports. And Attorney General Myers, of course, supports the bill as well. You've just heard about the Elder and Disabled Person Abuse Prevention Act. Senate Bill 118 deals with a couple of features of that act, and particularly under the act as it currently exists, an act of inappropriate sexual conduct involving an elderly or person with disability is not a ground for obtaining the kind of restraining order that you just heard described, unless that act also involves the infliction of substantial injury or other forms of injury that meet the current requirements of the law. And one part of Senate Bill 118 closes that loophole by adding the concept of sexual misconduct to the activities that can warrant the issuance of a restraining order. The second thing that the bill does is expand the act to cover financial abuse. And financial abuse is a big issue amongst particularly elderly persons. However, my colleagues in the Oregon State Bar Elder Law Section have raised what I think are some meritorious concerns about that part of the bill, and they can speak to those in more detail. What I think it's going to, my own judgment is it's going to be very difficult to cure those in the context of this bill, and is going to require an amount of work that I think more appropriately would be done during the interim. And so my suggestion to this committee and to my colleagues is that we ask this committee to move forward with the portion of the bill pertaining to the sexual misconduct and allow us to work during the interim to find a remedy for the financial abuse issue. I have provided to the committee a hand-engrossed form of amendments to the first page of the Act, which I have discussed with my colleagues from the Elder Law Section, and I think I can accurately represent to you that those are consensus amendments. The recommended form of amendment is attached as a stapled attachment to my written testimony. And with that, I'd stand open for questions.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, your staff has handed me a note to suggest that I address the question of changes to subsequent pages in the bill in addition to those indicated on the first page. I didn't go through the rest of the bill and do a hand-engrossed version on the rest of the bill because if the committee moves to work session and moves ahead with the amendments to page one, there are some conforming amendments that would be required on subsequent pages, but the operative portions to be addressed are just on that first page.
Okay. Thank you. We have Jennifer, do you and Claudia wish to come back up now? And also Ruth Simmons. I'll let you go ahead in whatever order you wish to.
Sure. Chair and members of the committee, I'll start out. I'm Claudia Burton again. We have worked with the folks on the Attorney General's Elder Abuse Task Force on some changes to Senate Bill 118 in the form as amended in the A engrossed version that was proposed. We do support it. We did have some concerns about having financial abuse in there, not because we're not worried about financial abuse, but because we were concerned about handling that issue in a summary proceeding like an ex parte restraining order. And so I think basically if the committee members have any questions at all about what that reasoning was or what those concerns were, we're happy to share those with you. And other than that, we fully support the efforts to protect seniors and disabled persons from sexual abuse and enable them to get restraining orders, and are very grateful to have the work of the Attorney General's Task Force on that. And can we answer any questions for you?
The only thing I see here is if there's going to be some amendments, we need to get the group working on that as soon as possible. So I guess what I would say, I'll instruct staff to work with you to delete some, and if not, whatever we have to add in subsequent pages to handle it that was mentioned here by the previous testimony.
Mr. Chair, I can certainly provide any sort of drafts to anyone and everybody involved.
Oh, that would be great.
Before it comes back.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, we're going to check and see if Mr. Johnson is available. Appears that he is not, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 118 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 119. And we'll ask Thomas Eldon and Bert Kopp. Well, go ahead, gentlemen, however you wish to.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Chair Fisher and Senators, it's a privilege to be here representing Attorney General Hardy Myers. We have a proposed amendment to the Elderly and Disabled Person Abuse Prevention Act, which I will refer to as the Abuse Prevention Act. There's currently no civil investigative demand or investigative authority under this statute. And many times reports of suspected, particularly financial abuse, are general in nature, and the persons making the reports often do not have access to financial records of the elderly or disabled person. So if we don't have, if we being the attorney general or a district attorney, doesn't have access to an investigative procedure, then we really can't either eliminate the suspicion of abuse or confirm it and focus an investigation or prosecution. So that might, in some cases, cases can and have been closed with no action. We have addressed the problem under existing law. In fact, in 1996, I believe I was the first attorney, or certainly our office was the first to bring an action under the then fairly new statute, and it was in the county of Wasco, but it's a living trust mill situation. But what we've done here is sometimes we can we may have enough evidence that we can bring an action in court, as in the case back in 1996, and we can also intervene in actions brought by others. We also, however, have used the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to investigate and bring actions against professionals who are financially exploiting seniors and disabled persons. And sometimes we have successfully referred matters to a district attorney's office. I can think of two cases right away. One a little bit north of here up the valley where a person's doing 2 years for securities fraud, and a person down in Medford who went to prison for sales of viatical investments on insurance policies, where you sort of gamble on another person's life. We need this additional authority because the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, it's a statute that focuses on businesses, business entities, and professional persons rather than a private party's treatment of another private party. And sometimes also an investigation under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act may not really have the right focus. I'm greatly generalizing here, but the Unlawful Trade Practices Act really, in many cases, not all cases, but revolves around misrepresentations that are made either through words or through conduct. And when you're talking about the financial exploitation of seniors, you may be talking about something that looks more like just a straight theft or something. And so sometimes it's hard to, even where you have a professional person involved, sometimes it may not be a good fit with the Unlawful Trade Practices Act for an investigation. And over the last couple of years, I believe, and statistics can always be worked around, but to the best of our knowledge, we've had about 60 complaints come into our office, and I won't break these down unless you want to hear further on it, but we've had about 60 complaints of private persons exploiting elderly and incapacitated persons. So the problem does exist, and of course we have no civil statutory authority to investigate those, and sometimes we've had to close cases for that very reason. We have one case in particular was a sort of a he said or she said type of thing, and we really couldn't unravel the facts because we didn't have a legitimate investigative tool. We couldn't shoehorn the investigation into something that it was not because the person involved, the suspected abuser, was not a professional. So we couldn't even begin to consider the Unlawful Trade Practices Act tools. And in one statistic is that in 2001, I don't know if this is necessarily mirrored by our own statistical evidence, but another agency reports that 65% of all financial elder and incapacitated person abuse cases involved a family member or a non-professional. And I've seen some statistics from Washington County District Attorney's Office, or Washington County, I should say, but it's clear that financial exploitation of the elderly, I won't say, I can't give you an accurate percentage from that study, but there are certainly cases where they are family members or non-professionals. So under the current statute, which is a great statute, we are limited in our ability to investigate. And this would import, basically word for word, the civil investigative demand procedures of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which seems like a pretty logical thing to do. And there is a body of case law that's grown up around that procedure. So presumably people would know what was involved, what could be done, what would need to be done to challenge something, or what couldn't be done. And so it would give us this power, this focused power, which would be an aid of, frankly, sorting things out. So we could decide, whether to stop, whether we should communicate with someone and get them to stop, or in some cases bring some type of an action. So we Attorney General Myers and our office heartily recommend this change, and I think it's overdue, and I don't think there'd be any fiscal impact on anybody. In fact, I think it would be a savings to get things sorted out outside the court arena. Thank you.
You considerably often hark back to the word power. I get a little scared once in a while when I hear that word thrown out too much.
Do you? So do I.
And primarily from the reason that it seems like when somebody has the power to get in and investigate, they somehow or another aren't willing to admit that perhaps there isn't any need for the investigation after they found it out. So they continue to utilize that power to just go on a big fishing expedition and cause nothing but grief and expense and all kinds of trips to keep continually testifying and stuff back up to Salem for people that are involved in our local areas. And do we have any assurance that something like this isn't going to provide for more of that?
Well, Chair Fisher, I can only speak from my own personal experience, and I think you raise a very interesting point. First of all, to my knowledge, under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, we are not hauling people from all over the state into Salem. We many times will go out and investigate in the field, or we'll have documents sent to Salem, or we will go to a place and conduct a deposition or something out, an investigatory procedure similar to a deposition outside of Salem. I think we don't want to confuse the ability of an elected official and his or her staff to protect the elderly and the disabled from an abuse of an investigatory power. And right now, I guess you could say that we are forced to use either other tools that don't fit so we don't get the job done, or cases of elderly and disabled persons abuse go begging. I can only tell you that I've been a lawyer for 30-some years. I'm very proud to be an assistant attorney general. I've worked in this financial fraud section for 10 years, working on cases, many of them involving seniors, like Publishers Clearing House and cases like that. And to my personal knowledge, the power that we have, and it is a considerable power, is used very judiciously. I think that if you have elected officials who are responsible to government and to the people, then you have a built-in restraint mechanism. I don't think that passing this amendment is going to mean that that there is a sort of a runaway, wholesale intrusion into people. We are not out shopping for cases. We're looking for legitimate reports that come in that need to be investigated. Without investigation, what can sometimes happen is that matters go, either they don't go anywhere or they go too far. So the power to investigate is a tool for finding the truth. And oftentimes that truth can work things out without even going into court. And many times, I can remember as a prosecutor, used to be a criminal prosecutor for many years ago in Los Angeles County, and I felt that as a prosecutor, Chair Fisher, I had more power to do good many times than the person on the other side, because the power to sort things out really rested with my side of the table. That's the only answer I can give you. I think you're putting the elected district attorneys and the elected attorney general are responsible to the electorate. And if it were discovered that investigations were being done in an unprofessional manner, I can assure you that that would not redound to their benefit.
I just, not being legally trained, it's hard for me to sort out always exactly the direction all these things take when they're put into effect. And I have some very vivid experiences with people that I feel have been very much unjustly impinged upon here. And one particular instance that sticks out in my mind and will for a good long time to come concerned a family situation and a son and a mother. And the mother was whisked away without his knowledge. She was not told where she went, could not find out where she went. They were the type of people, and I have some very good friends, two different sides of them as neighbors, they're known for their veracity and truthfulness, and it was always their whole family relationship from the time, literally for 25, 30, 40 years, had been one that was conducted at high volume and very pointed and very sprinkled with profanity and one thing and another, and that's the way they lived and dressed and talked to each other. And all of a sudden, somebody got a line on it and figured that there was abuse involved to the mother, who was getting to the point where she didn't really know much of what was going on. She was whisked away and ultimately died without the son even knowing where she was at or anything else. And it messed up their whole financial situation because they immediately then took her money to pay for her. And that was what they had gotten along together with. And in spite of anything the friends could say or anything they can do, there was allegations of physical abuse, all kinds of stuff. When the mother had repeatedly fallen, she would scramble around the neighborhood and fall sprawled out on the pavement time after time after time, and it just never could make any dent on the folks that were involved. And ultimately, as I said, she passed away without him even knowing or being able to see her or say goodbye or anything else. And I was very frustrated over that. And as I say, I don't read these things with a legal mind to know exactly how it fits in. Maybe it doesn't even fit in. Maybe it would have stopped something like that.
Well, it might have been, if there had been a financial or physical abuse, it might well have been advantageous if there had been a report to, say, the local district attorney or someone, and they had had the resources to investigate under a statute. I mean, and investigations are simply that. I mean, they're as good as the investigator, they're as good as the attorney directing the investigation, they're as good as the resources, they're as good as the information that people are willing to give the investigator. You know, there's a lot of things that go into that. Years ago, when I was in general counsel, we had a very tragic case of a woman who was beaten to death in a foster home, and trying to sort that out as to whether it was just a lot of bruising from her physical condition or whether someone, ended her life prematurely as a reason for a license revocation. Again, you're just, all this bill would do is to take an existing tried and true investigatory procedure that is not, I don't think there's any evidence that the district attorneys around the state or the attorney general are misusing, and move it over, copy it and super copy it into a statute to give us a tool to check things out, and to not try to use a tool for a business person or a professional that may not fit. And so we're just asking for this tool, and I can certainly speak for General Myers, whose ethics, as you know, are beyond reproach, that our office would use it responsibly if you give us this tool.
Just, I guess, for my own satisfaction in this, and kind of the brief outline I gave, if this bill were in effect, would that have allowed her son to have appealed to the district attorney?
Sir?
Had him investigate him, because basically he had nowhere to go.
Chair Fisher,
these were not legal people who were doing that. These were just state officials taking on their own. They weren't attorneys or anything like that.
It's hard for me to know from the summary of the facts that you've given to me, but I will say that if there had been a report to the Attorney General's office, someone had made a complaint that of finance, in the case that you're saying, you've sort of said that from your own investigation it looked like something had happened that shouldn't have happened, but maybe somebody had sorted things out the wrong way. All I can say, it's really difficult to speak to your hypothetical because I don't really have enough facts as to why the person was taken out of the home, but the statute that we're amending here is not all things to all people. It deals with financial and physical abuse, and currently there is no tool. Even if it had been reported to the local district attorney, they would have had to go with a different tool or no tool. So to the extent that those facts might have fit into something like, say, for example, financial exploitation, we had this case at the coast where two people are living together, and one of them suddenly deeds a multiple $100,000 property to another for $10. They're not a professional. We can't use the Unlawful Trade Practices Act for that. And it was a kind of she said type of thing. We couldn't really sort it out.
It wasn't a financial. It was strictly over an alleged physical abuse witnessed by somebody that didn't know the family.
Right.
And in a different setting.
The statute does deal with both the financial fraud consumer protection section of the Attorney General's office who would be using this the most would be using it primarily for financial abuse. But a district attorney might well have taken a tool like this and been able to use it for the other.
Mr. Cox.
I'm so glad to see this bill. I'll introduce myself. My name is Bertrand Kopp. I'm a senior advocate. The bill was not available to me when I watched my mother abused to death in front of my eyes, and I've never been able to do anything about it. I've been active in this field ever since then. That was since 1990. And I helped with the Elder Abuse Act of 1993, the rewrite of the guardianship law, and I've testified before other members of this legislature on elder affairs ever since. Your concern about someone using this for harassment, continually filing motions against somebody and running them all over heck, I think can be addressed by a restraining order if that person can appear and get a cease and desist order. So that particular phase of the thing he was talking about can be controlled through an existing legal practice. But we have for a long time heard stories about someone, a relative or a friend or a business acquaintance, absconding with an old person's money and not being able to get him back, even to appear in front of a court. I mean, he may have just fled the state. I think this is going to be a very good tool along that line. It's too late for my mother. It's too late for that case. But I'm sure hoping it can help in the future, and I'm all for this bill.
Okay. Chair Fisher, could I add a comment?
Yes, go right ahead.
I think the statement made by my colleague here is instructive in the sense of there are, as I said before, there is a body of law that's built up over the Unlawful Trade Practices civil investigative procedures, and targets of civil investigative demands who feel that they are improper may petition the court to set aside such a demand, not to necessarily issue a protective order, as my colleague stated, but as to the way an agency conducts itself, but to perhaps set it aside altogether. And So there are some court procedures available to someone, and we rarely see them because we use the tool that we have under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in such a way that we rarely see them, see objections to them. And if there are objections, oftentimes we can pull back and modify the demand for information without having a big, you know, fight somewhere about it.
Okay. I guess the amendment you referred to is this particular bill and not some amendment to this bill.
I'm sorry. When I talk about the Abuse Prevention Act itself is what I was missing. And so this is Senate Bill 119 amending that.
Yeah, I just want to make sure we didn't have
an
amendment we needed to deal
Thanks.
With.
Chair Fisher. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Question.
May I continue?
Oh, certainly.
The thing that happens amongst families, most commonly you see it. When one person has spent years maybe looking after an aging person, a last-minute greedy relative seizes that person through a fraudulent guardianship. They've got a lawyer to retain and a judge in his back pocket. And everybody accuses the person that's been doing the care of stealing their money without ever having to prove it, abusing the person without ever being able to cite a circumstance of when it's been true, and they take that person away from the one who has been caring for them and throw them into a home and leave them to die. It happened to my mother. And no one ever proved the accusations against me. No one was ever forced to prove the accusations against me. When in fact the relative stole thousands of dollars, disobeyed the court order, and abused her mother to death. No one ever prosecuted her. No one ever cared to prosecute her. There was no avenue open. I do hope you pass this bill because that avenue needs to be opened. And my case is only one of thousands. Anybody you talk to in the elder abuse area can list you case after case where the thing I'm speaking has happened. Those greedy last-minute relatives will do it every time. And I do urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you're willing just to come in, I know this must be something that brings back bad memories.
Thank you for your words.
Is there anyone that we should testify further on Senate Bill 119? Hearing none, I close the hearing on Senate Bill 119 and we're adjourned.
Thank you.